No. You're going to have some pain, though. I'll give you something for that before you go. Her smile faded, and suddenly she looked nervous. To be honest, Rose, I think most of the damage happened to, well, your face.
I shot up from the bed. What do you mean most of the damage happened to my face?
She gestured to the mirror above the sink on the far side of the room. I ran over to it and looked at my reflection.
Son of a bitch!
Purplish-red splotches covered the upper portion of the left side of my face, particularly near the eye. Desperately, I turned around to face her.
This is going to go away soon, right, if I keep ice on it?
She shook her head again. The ice can help, but I'm afraid you're going to have a wicked black eye. It'll probably be at its worst tomorrow, but should clear up in a week or so. You'll be back to normal before long.
I left the clinic in a daze that had nothing to do with my head injury. Clear up in a week or so? How could Dr. Olensky speak so lightly about this? Didn't she realize what was happening? I was going to look like a mutant for Christmas and most of the ski trip. I had a black eye. A freaking black eye. And my mother had given it to me.
Chapter 7. I angrily pushed through the double doors that led into the Moroi dorm. Snow swirled in behind me, and a few people lingering on the main floor glanced up upon my entrance. Not surprisingly, several of them did double takes. Swallowing, I forced myself not to react. It would be okay. No need to freak out. Novices got injured all the time. It was actually rarer not to get injured. Admittedly, this was a more noticeable injury than most, but I could live with it until it healed, right? And it wasn't like anyone would know how I'd received it.
Hey, Rose, is it true your own mother punched you?
I froze. I'd know that taunting soprano voice anywhere. Turning slowly, I looked into the deep blue eyes of Mia Rinaldi. Curly blonde hair framed a face that might have been cute, if not for the malicious smirk on it. A year younger than us, Mia'd taken on Lissa, and me by default, in a war to see who could tear apart the other's life most quickly. A war, I should add, that she started. It had involved her stealing Lissa's ex-boyfriend. Despite the fact Lissa had decided in the end she didn't want him, and the spreading of all sorts of rumors. Admittedly, Mia's hatred hadn't been entirely unjustified. Lissa's older brother Andre, who had been killed in the same car accident that technically killed me, had used Mia pretty badly when she was a freshman. If she weren't such a bitch now, I would have felt sorry for her. It had been wrong of him, and while I could understand her anger, I don't know that it was fair of her to take that out on Lissa in the way she did. Lissa and I had technically won the war in the end, but Mia had inexplicably bounced back. She didn't run with the same elite that she once had, but she had rebuilt a small contingent of friends. Malicious or not, strong leaders always attract followers. I'd found that about 90% of the time, the most effective response was to ignore her. But we had just crossed over to the other 10% because it's impossible to ignore someone announcing to the world that your mother just punched you, even if it was true. I stopped walking and turned around. Mia stood near a vending machine, knowing she'd drawn me out. I didn't bother asking how she'd found out about my mother giving me the black eye. Things rarely stayed secret around here. When she caught full sight of my face, her eyes widened in unabashed delight.
Wow! Talk about a face only a mother could love!
Huh! Cute. From anyone else, I would have applauded the joke.
Well, you're the expert on face injury, I said. How's your nose?
Mia's icy smile twitched a little, but she didn't back down. I'd broken her nose about a month ago, at a school dance of all places, and while the nose had since healed, it now sat just the tiniest bit askew. Plastic surgery could probably fix it up, but from my understanding of her family's finances, that wasn't possible just now.
It's better, she replied primly. Fortunately, it was only broken by a psychopathic whore and not anyone actually related to me.
I gave her my best psychopathic smile. Too bad. Family members hit you by accident. Psychopathic whores tend to come back for more. Threatening physical violence against her was usually a pretty sound tactic, but we had too many people around right now for that to be a legitimate concern for her, and Mia knew it. Not that I was above attacking someone in this kind of setting. Hell, I'd done it lots of times, but I was trying to work on my impulse control lately. "Doesn't look like much of an accident to me," she said. "Don't you guys have rules about face punches? I mean, that looks really far out of bounds." I opened my mouth to tell her off, but nothing came out. She had a point. My injury was far out of bounds. In that sort of combat, you aren't supposed to hit above the neck. This was way above that forbidden line. Mia saw my hesitation, and it was like Christmas morning had come a week early for her. Until that moment, I don't think there'd ever been a time in our antagonistic relationship in which she'd rendered me speechless.
"Ladies," came a stern female voice. The Maroi attending the front desk leaned over it and fixed us with a sharp look. "This is a lobby, not a lounge. Either go upstairs or go outside."
For a moment, breaking Mia's nose again sounded like the best idea in the world. To hell with detention or suspension. After a deep breath, I decided retreat was my most dignified action now. I stalked off toward the stairs leading up to the girls' dorm. Over my shoulder, I heard Mia call, "Don't worry, Rose, it'll go away. Besides, it's not your face guys are interested in." 30 seconds later, I beat on Liz's door so hard it was a wonder my fist didn't go through the wood. She opened it slowly and peered around. "Is it just you out here? I thought there was an army at the..." "Oh, my God." Her eyebrows shot up when she noticed the left side of my face. "What happened?" "You haven't heard already? You're probably the only one in the school who hasn't," I grumbled. "Just let me in." Sprawling on her bed, I told her about the day's events. She was properly appalled. "I heard you'd been hurt, but I figured it was one of your normal things," she said. I stared up at the spackled ceiling, feeling miserable. The worst part is, Mia was right. It wasn't an accident.
"What, you're saying your mom did it on purpose?"
When I didn't answer, Liz's voice turned incredulous. "Come on, she wouldn't do that, no way." "Why? Because she's perfect Janine Hathaway, master of controlling her temper?" "The thing is, she's also perfect Janine Hathaway, master of fighting and controlling her actions. One way or another, she slipped up."
"Yeah, well," said Lissa, "I think her stumbling and missing her punch is more likely than her doing it on purpose. She'd have to really lose her temper."
"Well, she was talking to me. That's enough to make anyone lose their temper. And I accused her of sleeping with my dad because he was the soundest evolutionary choice."
"Rose," groaned Lissa, "you kind of left out that part in your recap. Why'd you say that to her?"
"Because it's probably true."
"But you had to know it upset her. Why do you keep provoking her? Why can't you just make peace with her?"
I sat upright. "Make peace with her? She gave me a black eye, probably on purpose. How do I make peace with someone like that?" Lissa just shook her head and walked over to the mirror to check her makeup. The feelings coming through our bond were ones of frustration and exasperation. Lingering in the back was a bit of anticipation, too. I had the patience to examine her carefully, now that I'd finished my venting. She had on a silky lavender shirt and a knee-length black skirt. Her long hair had the kind of smooth perfection only achieved by spending an hour of your life on it with a hairdryer and flat iron.
"You look nice. What's up?"
Her feelings shifted slightly, her irritation with me dimming a little.
"I'm meeting Christian soon."
For a few minutes there, it had felt like the old days with Lissa and me. Just us, hanging out and talking. Her mention of Christian, as well as the realization that she'd have to leave me soon for him, stirred up dark feelings in my chest. Feelings I had to reluctantly admit were jealousy. Naturally, I didn't let on to that. "Wow, what'd he do to deserve that? Rescue orphans from a burning building? If so,
You might want to make sure he didn't set the building on fire in the first place.
Christian's element was fire. It was fitting since it was the most destructive one. Laughing, she turned from the mirror and noticed me gently touching my swollen face with my fingers. Her smile turned kind. It doesn't look that bad.
Whatever. I can tell when you're lying, you know. And Dr. Olensky says it'd be even worse tomorrow.
I lay back down on the bed. There probably isn't enough concealer in the world to cover this, is there? Tasha and I'll have to invest in some Phantom of the Opera-style masks.
She sighed and sat on the bed near me. Too bad I can't just heal it.
I smiled.
That would be nice.
The compulsion and charisma brought on by Spirit were great, but really, healing was her coolest ability. The range of things she could achieve was staggering. Lissa was also thinking about what Spirit could do.
I wish there was some other way to control the Spirit, in a way that still let me use the magic.
Yeah, I said. I understood her burning desire to do great things and help people. It radiated off of her. Hell, I would have also liked to have this eye cleared up in an instant rather than days.
I wish there were, too.
She sighed again. And there's more to me than just wishing I could heal and do other stuff with Spirit. I also, well, just miss the magic. It's still there. It's just blocked off by the pills. It's burning inside of me. It wants me, and I want it. But there's a wall between us. You just can't imagine it.
I can, actually.
It was true. Along with having a general sense for her feelings, I could sometimes also slip into her. It was hard to explain and even harder to endure. When that happened, I could literally see through her eyes and feel what she experienced. During those times, I was her. Many times, I'd been in her head while she longed for the magic, and I'd felt the burning need she spoke of. She often woke up at night, yearning for the power she could no longer reach.
Oh, yeah, she said ruefully. I forget about that sometimes.
A sense of bitterness filled her. It wasn't directed at me so much as it was the no-win nature of her situation. Anger sparked inside of her. She didn't like feeling helpless any more than I did. The anger and frustration intensified into something darker and uglier, something I didn't like.
Hey, I said, touching her arm. You okay?
She closed her eyes briefly, then opened them.
I just hate it.
The intensity of her feelings reminded me of our conversation, the one we'd had just before I went to the Badika house.
You still feel like the pills might be weakening?
I don't know. A little. Is it getting worse? She shook her head.
No, I still can't use the magic. I feel closer to it, but it's still blocked off.
But you still... your moods...
Yeah, they're acting up. But don't worry, she said, seeing my face. I'm not seeing things or trying to hurt myself.
Good. I was glad to hear it, but still worried. Even if she still couldn't touch the magic, I didn't like the idea of her mental state slipping again. Desperately, I hoped the situation would stabilize on its own.
I'm here, I told her softly, holding her gaze.
If anything happens that's weird, you tell me, okay? Like that, the dark feelings disappeared within her. As they did, I felt a weird ripple in the bond. I can't explain what it was, but I shuddered from the force. Lissa didn't notice. Her mood perked up again, and she smiled at me.
Thanks, she said. I will.
I smiled, happy to see her back to normal. We lapsed into silence, and for the briefest of moments, I wanted to pour my heart out to her. I'd had so much on my mind lately. My mother, Dimitri, and the Badika house. I'd been keeping those feelings locked up, and they were tearing me apart. Now, feeling so comfortable with Lissa for the first time in a long time, I finally felt that I could let her into my feelings for a change. Before I could open my mouth, I felt her thoughts suddenly shift. They became eager and nervous. She had something she wanted to tell me, something she'd been thinking about intently. So much for pouring my heart out. If she wanted to talk, I wouldn't burden her with my problems. So I pushed them aside and waited for her to speak.
I found something in my research with Miss Carmack. Something strange.
Oh?
I asked, instantly curious. Moroi usually developed their specialized element during adolescence. After that, they were put into magic classes specific to that element. But as the only spirit user on record at the moment, Lissa didn't really have a class she could join. Most people believe she just hadn't specialized. But she and Miss Carmack, the magic teacher at St. Vladimir's, had been meeting independently to learn what they could about spirit. They researched both current and old records, checking for clues that might lead to other spirit users, now that they knew some of the telltale signs, an inability to specialize, mental instability, etc. I didn't find any confirmed spirit users, but I did find reports of, unexplained phenomena. I blinked in surprise. What kind of stuff? I asked, pondering what would count as unexplained phenomena for vampires. When she and I had lived with humans, we would have been considered unexplained phenomena. They're scattered reports, but, like, I read this one about a guy who could make others see things that weren't there. He could get them to believe they were seeing monsters or other people or whatever. That could be compulsion. Really powerful compulsion. I couldn't do that, and I'm stronger, or used to be, in it than anyone we know. And that power comes from using spirit. So, I finished, you think this illusion guy must have been a spirit user, too? She nodded. Why not contact him and find out? Because there's no information listed. It's secret. And there are others just as strange, like someone who could physically drain others. People standing nearby would get weak and lose all their strength. They'd pass out, and there was someone else who could stop things in mid-air when they were thrown at him. Excitement lit up her features. He could have been an air user, I pointed out. Maybe, she said. I could feel the curiosity and excitement swirling through her. She desperately wanted to believe there were others out there like her. I smiled. Who knew? Moroi have Roswell? And Area 51 type stuff. It's a wonder I'm not being studied somewhere to see if they can figure out the bond. Lissa's speculative mood turned teasing. I wish I could see into your mind sometimes. I'd like to know how you feel about Mason. He's my friend, I said stoutly, surprised at the abrupt change in subject. That's it, she tisked. You used to flirt and do other stuff with any guy you could get your hands on. Hey, I said, offended. I wasn't that bad. Okay, maybe not, but you don't seem interested in guys anymore. I was interested in guys. Well, one guy. Mason's really nice, she continued, and crazy about you. He is, I agreed. I thought about Mason, about that brief moment when I thought he was sexy outside Stan's class. Plus, Mason was really funny, and we got along beautifully. He wasn't a bad prospect as far as boyfriends went. You guys are a lot alike. You're both doing things you shouldn't. I laughed. That was also true. I recalled Mason's eagerness to take on every Strigoi in the world. I might not be ready for that, despite my outburst in the car, but I shared some of his recklessness. It might be time to give him a shot, I thought. Bantering with him was fun, and it had been a long time since I'd kissed anyone. Dimitri made my heart ache, but, well, it wasn't like anything else was going on there. Lissa watched me appraisingly, like she knew what I was thinking. Well, aside from the Dimitri stuff. I heard Meredith say you were an idiot for not going out with him. She said it's because you think you're too good for him.
What? That's not true.
Hey, I didn't say it. Anyway, she said she's thinking of going after him.
Mason and Meredith? I scoffed. That's a disaster in the making. They have nothing in common.
It was petty. But I'd gotten used to Mason always doting on me. Suddenly, the thought of someone else getting him irked me.
You're possessive, Lissa said, again guessing my thoughts. No wonder she got so annoyed at me reading her mind.
Only a little. She laughed. Rose, even if it's not Mason, you really should start dating again. There are lots of guys who would kill to go out with you, guys who are actually nice.
I hadn't always made the best choices when it came to men. Once again, the urge to spill all my worries to her seized me. I'd been hesitant to tell her about Dimitri for so long, even though the secret burned inside of me.
Sitting with her here reminded me that she was my best friend. I could tell her anything and she wouldn't judge me. But, just like earlier, I lost the chance to tell her what was on my mind. She glanced over at her alarm clock and suddenly sprang up from the bed.
I'm late. I've got to meet Christian.
Joy filled her, underscored with a bit of nervous anticipation. Love. What could you do? I swallowed back the jealousy that started to raise its ugly head. Once again, Christian had taken her away from me. I wasn't going to be able to unburden myself tonight. Lissa and I left the dorm, and she practically sprinted away, promising we'd talk tomorrow. I wandered back to my own dorm. When I got to my room, I passed by my mirror and groaned when I saw my face. Dark purple surrounded my eye. In talking to Lissa, I'd almost forgotten about the whole incident with my mother. Stopping to get a closer look, I stared at my face. Maybe it was egotistical, but I knew I looked good. I wore a C-cup and had a body much coveted in a school where most of the girls were supermodel slim. And as I'd noted earlier, my face was pretty too. On a typical day, I was a 9 around here. 10 on a very good one. But today? Yeah, I was practically in negative numbers. I was going to look fabulous for the ski trip. My mom beat me up, I informed my reflection. It looked back sympathetically. With a sigh, I decided I might as well get ready for bed. There was nothing else I wanted to do tonight, and maybe extra sleep would speed the healing. I went down the hall to the bathroom to wash my face and brush my hair. When I got back to my room, I slipped on my favorite pajamas, and the feel of the soft flannel cheered me up a little. I was packing my backpack for the next day when a burst of emotion abruptly shot through my bond with Lissa. It caught me unaware and gave me no chance to fight it. It was like being knocked over by a hurricane-force wind, and suddenly, I was no longer looking at my backpack. I was inside Lissa, experiencing her world firsthand. And that's when things got awkward, because Lissa was with Christian, and things were getting hot. Chapter 8. Christian was kissing her, and wow, was it a kiss. He wasn't messing around. It was the kind of kiss that small children shouldn't be allowed to see. Hell, it was the kind of kiss no one should be allowed to see, let alone experience through a psychic link. As I've noted before, strong emotion from Lissa could make this phenomenon happen, the one where I got pulled inside her head. But always, always it was because of some negative emotion. She'd get upset or angry or depressed, and that would reach out to me. But this time, she wasn't upset. She was happy. Very, very happy. Oh, man, I needed to get out of here. They were up in the attic of the school's chapel, or, as I'd like to call it, their love nest. The place had been a regular hangout for them, back when each of them was feeling antisocial and wanted to escape. Eventually, they'd decided to be antisocial together, and one thing had led to another. Since they started publicly dating, I hadn't known they spent much time here anymore. Maybe they were back for old time's sake. And indeed, a celebration did seem to be going on. Little scented candles were set up around the dusty old place, candles that filled the air with the scent of lilacs. I would have been a little nervous about setting all those candles in a confined space, filled with flammable boxes and books, but Christian probably figured he could control any accidental infernos. They finally broke that insanely long kiss and pulled back to look at each other. They lay on their sides on the floor. Several blankets had been spread under them. Christian's face was open and tender as he regarded Lissa, his pale blue eyes aglow with some inner emotion. It was different from the way Mason regarded me. There was certainly adoration with him, but Mason's was a lot like when you walk into a church and fall to your knees in awe and fear of something you worship but don't really understand. Christian clearly worshipped Lissa, in his way, but there was a knowing glint to his eyes, a sense that the two of them shared an understanding of each other so perfect and powerful that they didn't even need words to convey it.
"Don't you think we are going to go to hell for this?" asked Lissa.
He reached out and touched her face,
trailing his fingers along her cheek and neck and down to the top of her silky shirt. She breathed heavily at that touch, at the way it could be so gentle and small, yet evoke such a strong passion within her.
"For this?"
He played with the shirt's edge, letting his finger just barely brush inside of it.
"No,"
she laughed. "For this." She gestured around the attic. "This is a church. We shouldn't be doing this kind of, thing up here."
"Not true,"
he argued. Gently, he pushed her onto her back and leaned over her.
"The church is downstairs. This is just storage. God won't mind."
"You don't believe in God," she chastised. Her hands made their way down his chest. Her movements were as light and deliberate as his, yet they clearly triggered the same powerful response in him. He sighed happily as her hands slid under his shirt and up his stomach.
"I'm humoring you."
"You'd say anything right now," she accused. Her fingers caught the edge of his shirt and pushed it up. He shifted so she could push it all the way off him and then leaned back over her, bare-chested.
"You're right,"
he agreed. He carefully undid one button on her blouse, just one. Then he again leaned down and gave her one of those hard, deep kisses. When he came up for air, he continued on as though nothing had happened.
"Tell me what you need to hear, and I'll say it."
He unfastened another button. "There's nothing I need to hear," she laughed. Another button popped free. "You can tell me whatever you want. It'd just be nice if it were true."
"The truth, huh? No one wants to hear the truth. The truth is never sexy. But you?"
The last button came undone, and he spread her shirt away.
"You are too goddamn sexy to be real."
His words held his trademark snarky tone, but his eyes conveyed a different message entirely. I was witnessing this scene through Lissa's eyes, but I could imagine what he saw. Her smooth, white skin, slender withered away.
"You are too goddamn sexy to be real."
His words held his trademark snarky tone, but his eyes conveyed a different message entirely. I was witnessing this scene through Lissa's eyes, but I could imagine what he saw. Her smooth, white skin, slender waist and hips, a lacy white bra. Through her, I could feel that the lace was itchy, but she didn't care. Feelings both fond and hungry spread over his features. From within Lissa, I could feel her heart race and breathing quicken. Emotions similar to Christian's clouded all other coherent thoughts. Shifting down, he lay on top of her, pressing their bodies together. His mouth sought hers out again, and as their lips and tongues made contact, I knew I had to get out of there. Because I understood it now. I understood why Lissa had dressed up and why the love nest had been decked out like a Yankee Candle showroom. This was it. The moment. After a month of dating, they were going to have sex. Lissa, I knew, had done it before with a past boyfriend. I didn't know Christian's past, but I sincerely doubted many girls had fallen prey to his abrasive charm. But in feeling what Lissa felt, I could tell that none of that mattered. Not in that moment. In that moment, there were only the two of them, and the way they felt about each other right now. And in a life filled with more worries than someone her age should have had, Lissa felt absolutely certain about what she was doing now. It was what she wanted. What she'd wanted for a very long time with him. And I had no right to be witnessing it. Who was I kidding? I didn't want to witness it. I took no pleasure in watching other people get it on, and I sure as hell didn't want to experience sex with Christian. It'd be like losing my virginity, virtually. But Jesus Christ, Lissa wasn't making it easy to get out of her head. She had no desire to detach from her feelings and emotions, and the stronger they grew, the stronger they held me. Trying to distance myself from her, I focused my energies on coming back to myself, concentrating as hard as I could. More clothes disappeared.
Come on, come on, I told myself sternly.
The condom came out.
Yikes. You're your own person, Rose. Get back in your head.
Their limbs intertwined, their bodies moving together.
Son of a...
I ripped out of her and back to myself. Once again, I was back in my room, but I no longer had any interest in packing my backpack. My whole world was askew. I felt strange and violated, almost unsure if I was Rose or if I was Lissa. I also felt that resentment toward Christian again. I certainly didn't want to have sex with Lissa, but there was that same pang inside of me, that frustrated feeling that I was no longer the center of her world. Leaving the backpack untouched, I went right to bed, wrapping my arms around myself and curling into a ball to try to squelch the ache within my chest. I fell asleep pretty quickly and woke up early as a result. Usually, I had to be dragged out of bed to go meet Dimitri, but today I showed up early enough that I actually beat him to the gym. As I waited, I saw Mason cutting across to one of the buildings that held classrooms.
Whoa, I called. Since when are you up this early?
Since I had to retake a math test, he said, walking over to me.
He gave me his mischievous smile.
Might be worth skipping, though, to hang out with you.
I laughed, remembering my conversation with Lissa. Yes, there are definitely worse things I can do than flirt and start something with Mason.
Nah, you might get in trouble. Then I'd have no real challenge on the slopes.
He rolled his eyes, still smiling.
I'm the one with no real challenge, remember?
You ready to bet on something yet? Or are you still too afraid?
Watch it, he warned. Or I might take back your Christmas present.
You got me a present? I hadn't expected that.
Yup. But if you keep backtalking, I might give it to someone else.
Like Meredith, I teased.
She isn't even in your league, and you know it.
Even with a black eye? I asked with a grimace.
Even with two black eyes.
The look he gave me just then wasn't teasing or even really suggestive. It was just nice. Nice, friendly, and interested. Like he really cared. After all the stress lately, I decided I liked being cared about. And with the neglect I was starting to feel from Lissa, I realized I also kind of liked having someone who wanted to pay so much attention to me.
What are you doing on Christmas? I asked.
He shrugged.
Nothing. My mom almost came down but had to cancel at the last minute. You know, with everything that happened.
Mason's mother wasn't a guardian. She was a dampier who'd chosen to just be domestic and have kids. As a result, I knew he saw her quite a bit. It was ironic, I thought, that my mom actually was here, but for all intents and purposes, she might as well have been somewhere else.
Come hang with me, I said on impulse. I'll be with Lissa and Christian and his aunt. It'll be fun.
Really?
Very fun.
That's not what I was asking about. I grinned.
I know. Just be there, okay?
He swept me one of the gallant bows he liked to make.
Absolutely.
Mason wandered off just as Dimitri showed up for our practice. Talking to Mason had made me feel giddy and happy. I hadn't thought about my face at all with him, but with Dimitri, I suddenly became self-conscious. I didn't want to be anything less than perfect with him. And as we walked inside, I went out of my way to avert my face so he couldn't look at me full on. Worrying about that brought my mood down. And as it plummeted, all the other things that had been upsetting me came tumbling back. We returned to the training room with the dummies, and he told me he simply wanted me to practice the maneuvers from 2 days ago. Happy he wasn't going to bring up the fight, I set to my task with a burning zeal, showing the dummies just what would happen if they messed with Rose Hathaway. I knew my fighting fury was fired up by more than just a simple desire to do well. My feelings were out of control this morning, raw and intense after both the fight with my mother and what I'd witnessed with Lissa and Christian last night. Dimitri sat back and watched me, occasionally critiquing my technique and offering suggestions for new tactics.
Your hair's in the way,
he said at one point.
Not only are you blocking your peripheral vision, you're running the risk of letting your enemy get a handhold.
If I'm actually in a fight, I'll wear it up, I grunted as I shoved the stake neatly up between the dummy's ribs. I didn't know what these artificial bones were made of, but they were a bitch to work around. I thought about my mom again and added a little extra force to the jab. I'm just wearing it down today, that's all.
Rose,
he said warningly. Ignoring him, I plunged again. His voice came more sharply the next time he spoke.
Rose, stop.
I backed away from the dummy, surprised to find my breathing labored. I hadn't realized I was working that hard. My back hit the wall. With nowhere to go, I looked away from him, directing my eyes toward the ground.
Look at me,
he ordered. Dimitri.
Look at me.
No matter our close history, he was still my instructor. I couldn't refuse a direct order. Slowly, reluctantly, I turned toward him, still tilting my head slightly down so the hair hung over the sides of my face. Rising from his chair, he walked over and stood before me. I avoided his eyes, but saw his hand move forward to brush back my hair. Then it stopped, as did my breathing. Our short-lived attraction had been filled with questions and reservations, but one thing I'd known for sure, Dimitri had loved my hair. Maybe he still loved it. It was great hair, I'll admit. Long and silky and dark. He used to find excuses to touch it, and he'd counseled me against cutting it, as so many female guardians did. His hand hovered there, and the world stood still as I waited to see what he would do. After what seemed like an eternity, he let his hand gradually fall back to his side. Burning disappointment washed over me, yet at the same time, I'd learned something. He'd hesitated. He'd been afraid to touch me, which maybe, just maybe, meant he still wanted to. He'd had to hold himself back. I slowly tipped my head back so that we made eye contact. Most of my hair fell back from my face, but not all. His hand trembled again, and I hoped again he'd reach forward. The hand steadied. My excitement dimmed.
Does it hurt?
He asked. The scent of that aftershave, mingled with his sweat, washed over me. God, I wish he had touched me. No, I lied.
It doesn't look so bad,
he told me.
It'll heal.
I hate her, I said, astonished at just how much venom those three words held. Even while suddenly turned on and wanting Dimitri, I still couldn't drop the grudge I held against my mother. No, you don't, he said gently.
I do. You don't have time to hate anyone, he advised, his voice still kind. Not in our profession. You should make peace with her.
Lissa had said exactly the same thing. Outrage joined my other emotions. The darkness within me stirred to unfurl. Make peace with her? After she gave me a black eye on purpose? Why am I the only one who sees how crazy this is?
She absolutely did not do it on purpose, he said, voice hard. No matter how much you resent her, you have to believe that. She wouldn't do that. And anyway, I saw her later that day. She was worried about you.
Probably more worried someone will bring her up on child abuse charges, I grumbled.
Don't you think this is the time of year for forgiveness?
I sighed loudly. This isn't a Christmas special. This is my life. In the real world, miracles and goodness just don't happen. He was still eyeing me calmly.
In the real world, you can make your own miracles.
My frustration suddenly hit a breaking point, and I gave up trying to maintain my control. I was so tired of being told reasonable, practical things whenever something went wrong in my life. Somewhere in me, I knew Dimitri only wanted to help, but I just wasn't up for the well-meant words. I wanted comfort for my problems. I didn't want to think about what would make me a better person. I wished he'd just hold me and tell me not to worry. Okay, can you just stop this for once? I demanded, hands on my hips.
Stop what?
The whole profound Zen crap thing. You don't talk to me like a real person. Everything you say is just some wise life lesson nonsense. You really do sound like a Christmas special.
I knew it wasn't entirely fair to take my anger out on him, but I found myself practically shouting.
I swear, sometimes it's just like you want to hear yourself talk. And I know you're not always this way. You're perfectly normal when you talk to Tasha, but with me? You're just going through the motions. You don't care about me. You're just stuck in your stupid mentor role.
He stared at me, uncharacteristically surprised.
I don't care about you?
No.
I was being petty. Very, very petty. And I knew the truth, that he did care, and was more than just a mentor. I couldn't help myself, though. It just kept coming and coming. I jabbed his chest with my finger.
I'm just another student to you. You just go on and on with your stupid life lessons so that...
The hand I'd hoped would touch my hair suddenly reached out and grabbed my pointing hand. He pinned it to the wall, and I was surprised to see a flare of emotion in his eyes. It wasn't exactly anger, but it was frustration of another kind.
Don't tell me what I'm feeling,
he growled. I saw then that half of what I'd said was true. He was almost always calm, always in control, even when fighting. But he'd also told me how he'd once snapped and beaten up his Maroi father. He'd actually been like me once, always on the verge of acting without thinking, doing things he knew he shouldn't.
That's it, isn't it?
I asked.
What?
You're always fighting for control. You're the same as me.
No,
he said, still obviously worked up.
I've learned my control.
Something about this new realization emboldened me.
No, I informed him. You haven't. You put on a good face, and most of the time you do stay in control. But sometimes you can't, and sometimes...
I leaned forward, lowering my voice.
Sometimes you don't want to.
Rose.
I could see his labored breathing and knew his heart was beating as quickly as mine. And he wasn't pulling away. I knew this was wrong, knew all the logical reasons for us staying apart. But right then, I didn't care. I didn't want to control myself. I didn't want to be good.
Before he realized what was happening, I kissed him. Our lips met, and when I felt him kiss me back, I knew I was right. He pressed himself closer, trapping me between him and the wall. He kept holding my hand, but his other one snaked behind my head, sliding into my hair. The kiss was filled with so much intensity. It held anger, passion, release. He was the one who broke it. He jerked away from me and took several steps back, looking shaken.
Do not do that again,
he said stiffly.
Don't kiss me back then, I retorted.
He stared at me for what seemed like forever.
I don't give Zen lessons to hear myself talk. I don't give them because you're another student. I'm doing this to teach you control.
You're doing a great job, I said bitterly.
He closed his eyes for half a second, exhaled, and muttered something in Russian. Without another glance at me, he turned and left the room.
Chapter 9. I didn't see Dmitri for a while after that. He'd sent me a message later that day saying he thought we should cancel our next two sessions because of the rapidly approaching plans to leave campus. Classes were about to end anyway, he said. Taking a break from practice seemed like the reasonable thing. It was a lame excuse, and I knew that wasn't the reason he was canceling. If he wanted to avoid me, I would have preferred he made up something about how he and the other guardians had to up Maroi security or practice top-secret ninja moves. Regardless of his story, I knew he was avoiding me because of the kiss. That damned kiss. I didn't regret it. Not exactly. God only knew how much I'd been wanting to kiss him. But I'd done it for the wrong reasons. I'd done it because I was upset and frustrated and had simply wanted to prove that I could. I was so tired of doing the right thing, the smart thing. I was trying to be more in control lately, but I seemed to be slipping. I hadn't forgotten the warning that he'd once given me, that us being together wasn't just about age. It would interfere with our jobs. Pushing him into the kiss? Well, I'd fanned the flames of a problem that could eventually hurt Lissa. I shouldn't have done it. Yesterday, I'd been unable to stop myself. Today, I could see more clearly and couldn't believe what I'd done. Mason met me on Christmas morning, and we went to hang out with the others. It provided a good opportunity to push Dimitri out of my head. I liked Mason. A lot. And it wasn't like I had to run off and marry him. Like Lissa had said, it would be healthy for me to just date someone again. Tasha was hosting our Christmas brunch in an elegant parlor in the Academy's guest quarters. Lots of group activities and parties were occurring throughout the school, but I'd quickly noticed that Tasha's presence always created a disturbance. People either secretly stared or went out of their way to avoid her. Sometimes she would challenge them. Sometimes she would just lie low. Today, she'd chosen to stay out of the other royals' way and simply enjoy this small, private party of those who didn't shun her. Dimitri had been invited to the gathering, and a bit of my resolve faltered when I saw him. He'd actually dressed up for the occasion. Okay, dressed up might have been an exaggeration, but it was the closest I'd ever seen him come to that. Usually, he just looked a little rough, like he could spring into battle at any given moment. Today, his dark hair was tied at the back of his neck, as though he'd actually tried to make it neat. He wore his usual jeans and leather boots, but instead of a t-shirt or thermal shirt, he had on a finely knit black sweater. It was just an ordinary sweater, nothing designer or expensive, but it added a touch of polish I didn't usually see, and good God did it fit him well. Dimitri wasn't mean to me or anything, but he certainly didn't go out of his way to make conversation with me. He did talk to Tasha, however, and I watched with fascination as they conversed in that easy way of theirs. I'd since learned that a good friend of his was a distant cousin of Tasha's family. That was how the two of them knew each other.
Five?
Asked Dimitri in surprise. They were discussing the friend's children.
I hadn't heard that.
Tasha nodded.
It's insane, I swear. I don't think his wife's had more than 6 months off between kids. She's short, too, so she just gets wider and wider.
When I first met him, he swore he didn't even want kids.
Her eyes widened excitedly.
I know, I can't believe it. You should see him now. He just melts around them. I can't even understand him half the time. I swear he speaks more baby talk than English.
Dimitri smiled his rare smile.
Well, children do that to people.
I can't imagine it happening to you, she laughed. You're always so stoic.
Of course. I suppose you'd be doing baby talk in Russian, so no one would ever know.
They both laughed at that, and I turned away, grateful Mason was there to talk to. He was a good distraction from everything, because in addition to Dimitri ignoring me, Lissa and Christian were chatting on in their own little world, too. Sex appeared to have made them much more in love, and I wondered if I'd get to spend any time with her at all on the ski trip. She did eventually break away from him to give me my Christmas present. I opened the box and stared inside. I saw a string of maroon-colored beads, and the scent of roses floated out. What the? I lifted the beads out, and a heavy gold crucifix swung from the end of them. She'd given me a tchotchke. It was similar to a rosary, only smaller, bracelet size.
Are you trying to convert me?
I asked wryly. Lissa wasn't a religious nut or anything, but she believed in God and attended church regularly. Like many Moroi families who'd come from Russia and Eastern Europe, she was an Orthodox Christian. Me? I was pretty much an Orthodox agnostic. I figured God probably existed, but I didn't have the time or energy to investigate. Lissa respected that and never tried to push her faith on me, which made the gift that much weirder.
Flip it over, she said, clearly amused at my shock. I did. On the back of the cross, a dragon wreathed in flowers had been carved into the gold. The Dragomir crest. I looked up at her, puzzled. It's a family heirloom, she said. One of my dad's good friends has been saving boxes of his stuff. This was in it. It belonged to my great-grandmother's guardian.
Liss, I said. The tchotchke took on a whole new meaning. I can't. You can't give me something like this.
Well, I certainly can't keep it. It's meant for a guardian. My guardian.
I wound the beads around one wrist. The cross felt cool against my skin.
You know, I teased, there's a good possibility I'll get kicked out of school before I can become your guardian.
She grinned. Well, then you can give it back. Everyone laughed. Tasha started to say something, then stopped when she looked up at the door.
Janine!
My mother stood there, looking as stiff and impassive as ever.
Sorry I'm late, she said. I had business to take care of.
Business, as always, even on Christmas. I felt my stomach turn and heat rise to my cheeks as the details of our fight came rushing back to my mind. She'd never sent one word of communication since it had happened 2 days ago, not even when I was in the infirmary. No apologies, nothing. I gritted my teeth. She sat down with us and soon joined the conversation. I'd long since discovered she could really only talk about one subject, guardian business. I wondered if she had any hobbies. The Badika attack was on everyone's mind, and this drove her into a conversation about some similar fight she'd been in. To my horror, Mason was riveted by her every word.
Well, decapitations aren't as easy as they seem, she said in her matter-of-fact way.
I'd never thought they were easy at all, but her tone suggested that she believed everyone thought they were cake.
You've got to get through the spinal cord and tendons.
Through the bond, I felt Lissa grow queasy. She wasn't one for gruesome talk. Mason's eyes lit up.
What's the best weapon to do it with?
My mother considered.
An axe. You can get more weight behind it.
She made a swinging motion by way of illustration.
Cool, he said.
Man, I hope they let me carry an axe.
It was a comical and ludicrous idea, since axes were hardly convenient weapons to carry around. For half a second, the thought of Mason walking down the street with an axe over his shoulder lightened my mood a little. The moment quickly passed. I honestly couldn't believe we were having this conversation on Christmas. Her presence had soured everything. Fortunately, the gathering eventually dispersed. Christian and Lissa went off to do their own thing, and Dimitri and Tasha apparently had more catching up to do. Mason and I were well on our way to the Dampier dorm when my mother joined us. None of us said anything. Stars cluttered the black sky, sharp and bright. Their glitter matched in the ice and snow around us. I wore my ivory parka with fake fur trimming. It did a good job keeping my body warm, even though it did nothing against the chilly gusts that seared my face. The whole time we walked, I kept expecting my mother to turn off toward the other guardian areas, but she came right inside the dorm with us.
I've been wanting to talk to you, she finally said.
My alarms clicked on. What had I done now? That was all she said, but Mason picked up on the hint immediately. He was neither stupid nor oblivious to social cues, though at that moment, I kind of wished he was. I also found it ironic that he wanted to fight every Strigoi in the world but was afraid of my mother. He glanced at me apologetically, shrugged, and said, "Hey, I've gotta get, somewhere. I'll see you later." I watched with regret as he left, wishing I could run after him. Probably my mom would only tackle me and punch my other eye if I tried to escape. Better to do things her way and get this over with. Shifting uncomfortably, I looked everywhere but at her and waited for her to speak. Out of the corner of my eye, I noticed a few people glancing over at us. Recalling how everyone in the world seems to know about her giving me the black eye,
I suddenly decided I didn't want witnesses around for whatever lecture she was about to unleash on me.
"You want to, go to my room?"
I asked. She looked surprised, almost uncertain.
"Sure."
I led her upstairs, keeping a safe distance away as we walked. Awkward tension built between us. She didn't say anything when we reached my room, but I saw her examine every detail carefully, as though a Strigoi might be lurking in there. I sat on the bed and waited while she paced, unsure what I should do. She ran her fingers over a stack of books on animal behavior and evolution.
"Are these for a report?"
she asked. "No, I'm just interested in it, that's all." Her eyebrows rose. She hadn't known that. But how would she? She didn't know anything about me. She continued her appraisal, stopping to study little things that apparently surprised her about me. A picture of Lissa and me dressed up like fairies for Halloween. A bag of sweet tarts. It was as though my mother were meeting me for the first time. Abruptly, she turned and extended her hand toward me.
"Here."
Startled, I leaned forward and held my palm out underneath hers. Something small and cool dropped into my hand. It was a round pendant, a small one, not much bigger than a dime in diameter. A base of silver held a flat disc of colored glass circles. Frowning, I ran my thumb over its surface. It was strange, but the circles almost made it look like an eye. The inner one was small, just like a pupil. It was so dark blue that it looked black. Surrounding it was a larger circle of pale blue, which was in turn surrounded by a circle of white. A very, very thin ring of that dark blue color circled the outside.
"Thanks," I said. I hadn't expected anything from her. The gift was weird. Why the hell would she give me an eye? But it was a gift. I didn't get you anything."
My mom nodded, face blank and unconcerned once more.
"It's fine. I don't need anything."
She turned away again and started walking around the room. She didn't have a lot of space to do it, but her shorter height gave her a smaller stride. Each time she passed in front of the window over my bed, the light would catch her auburn hair and light it up. I watched her curiously and realized she was as nervous as me. She halted in her pacing and glanced back toward me.
"How's your eye?"
"Getting better."
"Good."
She opened her mouth, and I had a feeling she was on the verge of apologizing, but she didn't. When she started pacing again, I decided I couldn't stand the inactivity. I began putting my presents away. I'd gotten a pretty nice haul of stuff this morning. One of them was a silk dress from Tasha, red and embroidered with flowers. My mother watched me hang it in the room's tiny closet.
"That was very nice of Tasha."
"Yeah," I agreed. "I didn't know she was going to get me anything. I really like her."
"Me too."
I turned from the closet in surprise and stared at my mom. Her astonishment mirrored mine. If I hadn't known any better, I'd have said we'd just agreed on something. Maybe Christmas miracles did happen.
"Guardian Belkov will be a good match for her."
I blinked, not entirely sure what she was talking about. "Dmitri?"
"Guardian Belkov,"
she corrected sternly, still not approving of my casual way of addressing him.
What kind of match?" I asked.
She raised an eyebrow.
"You haven't heard. She's asked him to be her guardian, since she doesn't have one."
I felt like I'd been punched again. "But he's assigned here, and to Lissa."
"Arrangements can be made, and regardless of the Ozera reputation, she's still royal. If she pushes, she can get her way."
I stared bleakly into space. "Well, I guess they are friends and everything."
"More than that, or possibly could be."
Bam! Punched again. "What?"
"Hmm? Oh, she's interested in him."
By my mother's tone, it was clear that romantic matters actually held no interest for her.
"She's willing to have Dampier children, so it's possible they might eventually make an,
arrangement, if he were her guardian.
Oh, my God. Time froze. My heart stopped beating. I realized my mother was waiting for a response. She was leaning against my desk, watching me. She might be able to hunt down Strigoi, but she was oblivious to my feelings.
Is he going to do it? Be her guardian? I asked, weakly.
My mom shrugged.
I don't think he's agreed to it yet. But of course he will. It's a great opportunity.
Of course, I echoed. Why would Dimitri turn down the chance to be a guardian to a friend of his and to have a baby? I think my mom said something else after that, but I didn't hear it. I didn't hear anything. I kept thinking about Dimitri leaving the academy, leaving me. I thought about the way he and Tasha had gotten along with each other so well. And then, after those recollections, my imagination started improvising future scenarios. Tasha and Dimitri together. Touching. Kissing. Naked. Other things. I squeezed my eyes shut for half a second and then opened them. I'm really tired. My mom stopped mid-sentence. I had no idea what she'd been saying before I interrupted her. I'm really tired, I repeated. I could hear the hollowness in my own voice. Empty. No emotion. Thanks for the eye, thing. But if you don't mind... My mother stared at me in surprise, her features open and confused. Then, just like that, her usual wall of cool professionalism slammed back into place. Until that moment, I hadn't realized how much she'd let it up. But she had. For just a brief time, she'd made herself vulnerable with me. That vulnerability was now gone.
Of course, she said stiffly. I don't want to bother you.
I wanted to tell her it wasn't that. I wanted to tell her I wasn't kicking her out for any personal reason. And I wanted to tell her that I wished she were the kind of loving, understanding mother you always hear about, one I could confide in, maybe even a mother I could discuss my troubled love life with. God, I wished I could tell anyone about that, actually, especially right now. But I was too caught up in my own personal drama to say a word. I felt like someone had ripped my heart out and tossed it across the other side of the room. There was a burning, agonizing pain in my chest, and I had no idea how it could ever be filled. It was one thing to accept that I couldn't have Dimitri. It was something entirely different to realize someone else could. I didn't say anything else to her because my speech capabilities no longer existed. Fury glinted in her eyes, and her lips flattened out into that tight expression of displeasure she so often wore. Without another word, she turned around and left, slamming the door behind her. That door slam was something I would have done too, actually. I guess we really did share some genes. But I forgot about her almost immediately. I just kept sitting there and thinking, thinking and imagining. I spent the rest of the day doing little more than that. I skipped dinner. I shed a few tears. But mostly, I just sat on my bed, thinking and growing more and more depressed. I also discovered that the only thing worse than imagining Dimitri and Tasha together was remembering when he and I had been together. He would never touch me again like that. Never kiss me again. This was the worst Christmas ever.
Chapter 10.
The ski trip couldn't have come a moment too soon. It was impossible to get the Dimitri and Tasha thing out of my head, but at least packing and getting ready made sure I didn't devote 100% of my brain power to him. More like 95%. I had other things to distract me, too. The Academy might, rightfully, be overprotective when it came to us, but sometimes that translated into pretty cool stuff. Example, the Academy had access to a couple of private jets. This meant no Strigoi could attack us at an airport, and it also meant we got to travel in style. Each jet was smaller than a commercial plane, but the seats were cushy and had lots of legroom.
They extended far enough back that you could practically lie down to sleep. On long flights, we had little consoles in the seats that gave us TV movie options. Sometimes they'd even break out fancy meals. I was betting this flight, however, would be too short for any movies or substantial food. We left late on the 26th. When I boarded the jet, I looked around for Lissa, wanting to talk to her. We hadn't really spoken after the Christmas brunch. I wasn't surprised to see her sitting with Christian, and they didn't look like they wanted to be interrupted. I couldn't hear their conversation, but he'd put his arm around her and had that relaxed, flirty expression that only she could bring out. I remained fully convinced that he could never do as good a job as me of taking care of her, but he clearly made her happy. I put on a smile and nodded at them as I passed down the aisle toward where Mason was waving at me. As I did, I also walked by Dimitri and Tasha sitting together. I pointedly ignored them. "Hey," I said, sliding into the seat beside Mason. He smiled at me.
"Hey, you ready for the ski challenge?"
"As ready as I'll ever be." "Don't worry," he said.
"I'll go easy on you."
I scoffed and leaned my head back against the seat.
"You're so delusional." "Sane guys are boring."
To my surprise, he slid his hand over mine. His skin was warm, and I felt my own skin tingle where he touched me. It startled me. I'd convinced myself Dimitri was the only one I'd ever respond to again. "It's time to move on," I thought. "Dimitri obviously has. You should have done it a long time ago." I laced my fingers with Mason's, catching him off guard. "I do. This is going to be fun." And it was. I tried to keep reminding myself that we were here because of a tragedy, that there were Strigoi and humans out there who might strike again. No one else seemed to remember that, though, and I admit, I was having a difficult time myself. The resort was gorgeous. It was built to sort of look like a log cabin, but no pioneer cabin could have held hundreds of people or had such luxury accommodations. 3 stories of gleaming golden-color wood sat among lofty pine trees. The windows were tall and gracefully arched, tinted for Moroi convenience. Crystal lanterns, electric, but shaped to look like torches, hung around all the entrances, giving the entire building a glittering, almost bejeweled look. Mountains, which my enhanced eyes could just barely make out in the night, surrounded us, and I bet the view would have been breathtaking when it was light out. One side of the grounds led off to the skiing area, complete with steep hills and moguls, as well as lifts and tow ropes. Another side of the lodge had an ice rink, which delighted me since I'd missed out that one day by the cabin. Near that, smooth hills were reserved for sledding. And that was just the outside. Inside, all sorts of arrangements had been made to cater to Moroi needs. Feeders stayed on hand, ready to serve 24 hours a day. The slopes ran on a nocturnal schedule. Wards and guardians circled the entire place. Everything a living vampire could want. The main lobby had a cathedral ceiling and an enormous chandelier hanging over it. Its floor was intricately tiled marble, and the front desk stayed open around the clock, ready to indulge our every need. The rest of the lodge, hallways and lounges, had a red, black, and gold color scheme. The deep shade of red dominated over the other hues, and I wondered if its resemblance to blood was a coincidence. Mirrors and art adorned the walls, and little ornamental tables had been placed here and there. They held vases of pale green, purple-spotted orchids that filled the air with a spicy scent. The room I shared with Lissa was bigger than our dorm rooms put together and had the same rich colors as the rest of the lodge. The carpet was so plush and deep that I immediately shed my shoes at the door and walked in barefoot, luxuriating in the way my feet sank into that softness. We had king-size beds, covered in feather duvets, and set with so many pillows that I swore a person could get lost in them all and never be seen again. French doors opened onto a spacious balcony, which, considering we were on the top floor, would have been cool if not for the fact it was freezing outside.
I suspected the two-person hot tub on the far end would go a long way to make up for the cold. Drowning in so much luxury, I reached an overload point where the rest of the accommodations started swimming together. The jetted marble bathtub, the plasma screen TV, the basket of chocolate and other snacks. When we finally decided to go skiing, I had to practically drag myself from the room. I could probably have spent the rest of my vacation lounging in there and been perfectly content. But we finally ventured outside, and once I managed to push Dimitri and my mother out of my head, I started to enjoy myself. It helped that the lodge was so enormous, there was little chance of running into them. For the first time in weeks, I was able to finally focus on Mason and realize just how much fun he was. I also got to hang out with Lissa more than I had in a while, which put me in an even better mood. With Lissa, Christian, Mason, and me, we were able to get a kind of double date thing going. The four of us spent almost all of the first day skiing, though the two Maroi had a bit of trouble keeping up. Considering what Mason and I went through in our classes, he and I weren't afraid to try daring stunts. Our competitive natures made us eager to go out of our way to outdo each other.
"You guys are suicidal," remarked Christian at one point.
It was dark outside, and tall light posts illuminated his bemused face. He and Lissa had been waiting at the bottom of the Mogul Hill, watching Mason and me come down. We'd been moving at insane speeds. The part of me that had been trying to learn control and wisdom from Dimitri knew it was dangerous, but the rest of me liked embracing that recklessness. That dark streak of rebelliousness still hadn't let me go. Mason grinned as we skidded to a halt, sending up a spray of snow.
"Nah, this is just a warm-up. I mean, Rose has been able to keep up with me the whole time. Kid stuff."
Lissa shook her head. "Aren't you guys taking this too far?" Mason and I looked at each other.
"No."
She shook her head. "Well, we're going inside. Try not to kill yourselves." She and Christian left, arm in arm. I watched them go, then turned back to Mason.
"I'm good for a while longer. You?"
"Absolutely."
We took a lift back up to the top of the hill. When we were just about to head down, Mason pointed.
"Okay,
how about this? Hit those moguls there, then jump over that ridge, swing back with a hairpin turn, dodge those trees, and land there." I followed his finger as he pointed out a jagged path down one of the biggest slopes. I frowned. "That one really is Insane Mace."
"Ah,"
he said triumphantly. "She finally cracks." I glowered. "She does not." After another survey of his crazy route, I conceded.
"Okay, let's do it,"
he gestured.
"You first."
I took a deep breath and leapt off. My skis slid smoothly over the snow, and piercing wind blasted into my face. I made the first jump neatly and precisely, but as the next part of the course sped forward, I realized just how dangerous it really was. In that split second, I had a decision to make. If I didn't do it, I'd never hear the end of it from Mason, and I really wanted to show him up. If I did manage it, I could feel pretty secure about my awesomeness. But if I tried and messed up, I could break my neck. Somewhere in my head, a voice that sounded suspiciously like Dimitri's started talking about wise choices and learning when to show restraint. I decided to ignore that voice and went for it. This course was as hard as I'd feared, but I pulled it off flawlessly, one insane move after another. Snow flew up around me as I made each sharp, dangerous turn. When I safely reached bottom, I looked up and saw Mason gesturing wildly. I couldn't make out his expression or words, but I could imagine his cheers. I waved back and waited for him to follow suit. But he didn't. Because when Mason got halfway down, he wasn't able to pull off one of the jumps. His skis caught, and his legs twisted. Down he went. I reached him at about the same time some of the resort staff did. To everyone's relief, Mason hadn't broken his neck or anything else. His ankle did appear to have a nasty sprain, however,
which was probably going to limit his skiing for the rest of the trip. One of the instructors monitoring the slopes ran forward, fury all over her face.
"What were you kids thinking?" she exclaimed. She turned on me. "I couldn't believe it when you did those stupid stunts."
Her glare fixed on Mason next.
"And then you had to go ahead and copy her."
I wanted to argue that it had been all his idea, but blame didn't matter at this point. I was just glad he was all right. But as we all went inside, guilt began to gnaw at me. I had acted irresponsibly. What if he'd been seriously injured? Horrible visions danced through my mind. Mason with a broken leg. A broken neck. What had I been thinking? No one had made me do that course. Mason had suggested it. I hadn't fought back. Goodness knew I probably could have. I might have had to endure some mockery, but Mason was crazy enough about me that feminine wiles probably would have stopped this madness. I'd gotten caught up in the excitement and the risk. Much as I had in kissing Dimitri, not giving enough thought to the consequences because secretly, inside of me, that impulsive desire to be wild still lurked. Mason had it too, and his called to me. That mental Dimitri voice chastised me once more. After Mason was safely returned to the lodge and had ice on his ankle, I carried our equipment back outside toward the storage buildings. When I went back inside, I went through a different doorway than I normally used. This entrance was set behind a huge, open porch with an ornate wooden railing. The porch was built into the side of the mountain and had a breathtaking view of the other peaks and valleys around us, if you felt like standing around long enough in freezing temperatures to admire it, which most people didn't. I walked up the steps to the porch, stomping snow off my boots as I did. A thick scent, both spicy and sweet, hung in the air. Something about it felt familiar, but before I could identify it, a voice suddenly spoke to me out of the shadows.
"Hey, little Dampier."
Startled, I realized someone was indeed standing on the porch. A guy. A Moroi, leaned against the wall not far from the door. He brought a cigarette up to his mouth, took a long drag, and then dropped it on the floor. He stamped the butt out and crooked me a smile. That was the scent, I realized. Clove cigarettes. Warily, I stopped and crossed my arms as I took him in. He was a little shorter than Dimitri, but wasn't as lanky as some Moroi guys ended up looking. A long charcoal coat, probably made out of some insanely expensive cashmere wool blend, fit his body exceptionally well, and the leather dress shoes he wore indicated more money still. He had brown hair that looked like it had been purposely styled to appear a little unkempt, and his eyes were either blue or green. I didn't have quite enough light to know for sure. His face was cute, I supposed, and I pegged him to be a couple years older than me. He looked like he'd just come from a dinner party.
"Yeah?"
I asked. His eyes swept over my body. I was used to attention from Moroi guys. It just usually wasn't so obvious. And I usually wasn't bundled up in winter clothing and sporting a black eye. He shrugged.
"Just saying hi, that's all."
I waited for more, but all he did was stuff his hands into the coat's pockets. With a shrug of my own, I took a couple steps forward.
"You smell good, you know,"
he suddenly said. I stopped walking again and gave him a puzzled look, which only made his sly smile grow a little bigger.
What?
"You smell good," he repeated. "Are you joking? I've been sweating all day. I'm disgusting." I wanted to walk away, but there was something eerily compelling about this guy. Like a train wreck. I didn't find him attractive per se. I was just suddenly interested in talking to him.
"Sweat isn't a bad thing,"
he said, leaning his head against the wall and looking upward thoughtfully.
"Some of the best things in life happen while sweating."
"Yeah. If you get too much of it and it gets old and stale, it turns pretty gross. But on a beautiful woman, intoxicating. If you could smell things like a vampire does, you'd know what I'm talking about. Most people mess it all up and drown themselves in perfume. Perfume can be good, especially if you get one that goes with your chemistry. But you only need a hint. Mix about 20% of that with 80% of your own perspiration.
He tilted his head to the side and looked at me.
Dead sexy.
I suddenly remembered Dimitri and his aftershave. Yeah, that had been dead sexy, but I certainly wasn't going to tell this guy about it. Well, thanks for the hygiene lesson, I said, but I don't own any perfume, and I'm going to go shower all this hot, sweaty action off me. Sorry.
He pulled out a pack of cigarettes and offered it to me. He moved only a step closer, but it was enough for me to smell something else on him. Alcohol. I shook my head at the cigarettes, and he tapped one out for himself.
Bad habit, I said, watching him light it.
One of many, he replied.
He inhaled deeply.
You here with St. Vlad's?
Yep.
So you're going to be a guardian when you grow up.
Obviously. He exhaled smoke, and I watched it drift away into the night. Heightened vampire senses or no, it was a wonder he could smell anything around those cloves.
How long until you grow up? He asked. I might need a guardian.
I graduate in the spring, but I'm already spoken for. Sorry. Surprise flickered in his eyes.
Yeah? Who is he?
She's Vasilisa Dragomir.
Ah.
His face split into a huge grin.
I knew you were trouble as soon as I saw you. You're Janine Hathaway's daughter.
I'm Rose Hathaway, I corrected, not wanting to be defined by my mother.
Nice to meet you, Rose Hathaway.
He extended a gloved hand to me that I hesitantly took.
Adrian Ivashkov.
And you think I'm trouble? I muttered. The Ivashkovs were a royal family, one of the wealthiest and most powerful. They were the kind of people who thought they could get anything they wanted and walked over those in their way. No wonder he was so arrogant. He laughed. He had a nice laugh, rich and almost melodious. It made me think of warm caramel dripping from a spoon.
Handy, huh?
Each of our reputations precedes us.
I shook my head. You don't know anything about me, and I only know your family. I don't know anything about you.
Want to?
He asked, tauntingly. Sorry, I'm not into older guys.
I'm 21. Not that much older.
I have a boyfriend. It was a small lie. Mason certainly wasn't my boyfriend yet, but I hoped Adrian would leave me alone if he thought I was taken.
Funny you didn't mention that right away, Adrian mused. He didn't give you that black eye, did he?
I felt myself blushing, even in the cold. I'd been hoping he wouldn't notice the eye, which was stupid. With his vampire eyes, he'd probably noticed as soon as I stepped onto the porch. He wouldn't be alive if he did. I got it during practice. I mean, I'm training to be a guardian. Our classes are always rough.
That's pretty hot, he said.
He dropped the second cigarette to the ground and put it out with his foot. Punching me in the eye?
Well, no, of course not. I meant that the idea of rough with you is hot. I'm a big fan of full contact sports.
I'm sure you are, I said dryly. He was arrogant and presumptuous, yet I still couldn't quite force myself to leave. The sound of footsteps behind me made me turn. Maya came around the path and walked up the steps. When she saw us, she stopped suddenly. Hey, Maya. She glanced between the two of us.
Another guy?
She asked. From her tone, you would have thought I had my own harem of men. Adrian gave me a questioning, amused look. I gritted my teeth and decided not to dignify that with a response. I opted for uncharacteristic politeness. Maya? This is Adrian Ivashkov. Adrian turned on the same charm he'd used on me. He shook her hand.
Always a pleasure to meet a friend of Rose's, especially a pretty one.
He spoke like he and I had known each other since childhood. We aren't friends, I said. So much for politeness.
Rose only hangs out with guys and psychopaths, said Maya.
Her voice carried the usual scorn she harbored for me, but there was a look on her face that showed Adrian had clearly caught her interest.
Well, he said cheerfully,
since I'm both a psychopath and a guy, that would explain why we're such good friends.
You and I aren't friends either, I told him. He laughed.
Always playing hard to get, huh?
She's not that hard to get, said Maya, clearly upset that Adrian was paying more attention to me.
Just ask half the guys at our school.
Yeah, I retorted. And you can ask the other half about Maya. If you can do a favor for her, she'll do lots of favors for you. When she'd declared war on Lissa and me, Maya had managed to get a couple of guys to tell everyone at school that I'd done some pretty awful things with them. The ironic thing was that she'd gotten them to lie for her by sleeping with them herself. A flicker of embarrassment passed over her face, but she held her ground.
Well, she said, at least I don't do them for free.
Adrian made some cat noises. Are you done? I asked. It's past your bedtime, and the grown-ups would like to talk now. Maya's youthful looks were a sore point with her, one I frequently enjoyed exploiting. Sure, she said crisply. Her cheeks turned pink, intensifying her porcelain doll appearance.
I have better things to do anyway.
She turned toward the door, then paused with her hand resting on it. She glanced toward Adrian.
Her mom gave her that black eye, you know.
She went inside. The fancy glass doors swung shut behind her. Adrian and I stood there in silence. Finally, he took out the cigarettes again and lit another.
Your mom?
Shut up.
You're one of those people who either has soulmates or mortal enemies, aren't you? No in between. You and Vasilisa are probably like sisters, huh?
I guess.
How is she?
Huh? What do you mean? He shrugged, and if I didn't know better, I'd have to say he was overdoing casualness.
I don't know, I mean, I know you guys ran away, and there was that stuff with her family and Victor Doshkov.
I stiffened at the reference to Victor.
So?
Dunno. Just figured it might be a lot for her to, you know, handle.
I studied him carefully, wondering what he was getting at. There had been a brief leak about Lissa's fragile mental health, but it had been well contained. Most people had forgotten about it or assumed it was a lie. I've gotta go. I decided avoidance was the best tactic just now.
Are you sure?
He sounded only mildly disappointed. Mostly, he seemed as cocky and amused as before. Something about him still intrigued me, but whatever it wasn't enough to combat everything else I was feeling, or to risk discussing Lissa.
I thought it was time for the grown-ups to talk. Lots of grown-up things I'd like to talk about.
It's late, I'm tired, and your cigarettes are giving me a headache, I growled.
I suppose that's fair.
He drew in on the cigarette and let out the smoke.
Some women think they make me look sexy.
I think you smoke them so you have something to do while you're thinking up your next witty line. He choked on the smoke, caught between inhaling and laughing.
Rose Hathaway? I can't wait to see you again. If you're this charming while tired and annoyed, and this gorgeous while bruised and in ski clothes, you must be devastating at your peak.
If by devastating you mean that you should fear for your life, then yeah, you're right. I jerked open the door. Good night, Adrian.
I'll see you soon.
Not likely, I told you. I'm not into older guys. I walked into the lodge. As the door closed, I just barely heard him call behind me.
Sure you aren't.
Chapter 11. Lissa was up and gone before I even stirred the next morning, which meant I had the bathroom to myself while I got ready for the day. I loved that bathroom. It was enormous. My king-size bed would have fit comfortably inside it. A scalding shower with three different nozzles woke me up, though my muscles ached from yesterday. As I stood in front of the full-length mirror and combed my hair, I saw with some disappointment that the bruise was still there. It was significantly lighter, however, and had turned yellowish. Some concealer and powder almost entirely covered it up. I headed downstairs in search of food. The dining room was just shutting down breakfast, but one of the waitresses gave me a couple of peach marzipan scones to go. Munching on one as I walked, I expanded my senses to get a feel for where Lissa was. After a couple of moments, I sensed her on the other side of the lodge, away from the student rooms. I followed the trail until I arrived at a room on the third floor. I knocked. Christian opened the door.
Sleeping Beauty arrives. Welcome.
He ushered me inside. Lissa sat cross-legged on the room's bed and smiled when she saw me. The room was as sumptuous as mine, but most of the furniture had been shoved aside to make space, and in that open area, Tasha stood.
Good morning,
she said. Hey, I said. So much for avoiding her. Lissa patted a spot beside her.
You've got to see this.
What's going on? I sat down on the bed and finished the last of the scone.
Bad things, she said, mischievously.
You'll approve. Christian walked over to the empty space and faced Tasha. They regarded each other, forgetting about Lissa and me. I'd apparently interrupted something.
So why can't I just stick with the consuming spell? Asked Christian.
Because it uses a lot of energy, she told him. Even with jeans and a ponytail, and the scar, she managed to look ridiculously cute.
Plus, it'll most likely kill your opponent, he scoffed. Why wouldn't I want to kill a Strigoi?
You might not always be fighting one.
Or maybe you need information from them. Regardless, you should be prepared either way.
They were practicing offensive magic, I realized. Excitement and interest replaced the sullenness I'd acquired upon seeing Tasha. Lissa hadn't been kidding about them doing bad things. I'd always suspected they were practicing offensive magic, but wow! Thinking about it and actually seeing it were two very different things. Using magic as a weapon was forbidden, a punishable offense. A student experimenting with it might be forgiven and simply disciplined. But for an adult, to actively be teaching a minor? Yeah, that could get Tasha in major trouble. For half a second, I toyed with the idea of turning her in. Immediately, I dismissed the notion. I might hate her for making moves on Dimitri, but part of me sort of believed in what she and Christian were doing. Plus, it was just cool.
A distracting spell is almost as useful, she continued.
Her blue eyes took on the intense focus I often saw Maroi get while using magic. Her wrist flicked forward, and a streak of fire snaked past Christian's face. It didn't touch him, but from the way he flinched, I suspected it had been close enough for him to feel the heat.
Try it, she told him.
Christian hesitated for only a moment and then made the same hand motion she had. Fire streaked out, but it had none of the finely tuned control hers had had. He also didn't have her aim. It went straight for her face, but before it could touch her, it parted and split around her, almost like it had hit an invisible shield. She deflected it with her own magic.
Not bad, aside from the fact that you would have burned my face off.
Even I wouldn't want her face burned off. But her hair? Ah, yes. We'd see how pretty she was without that raven black mane. She and Christian practiced a while longer. He improved as time went by, though he clearly had a ways to go before he had Tasha's skill. My interest grew and grew as they went on, and I found myself pondering all the possibilities this kind of magic could offer. They wrapped up their lesson when Tasha said she had to go. Christian sighed, clearly frustrated that he hadn't been able to master the spell in an hour. His competitive nature was almost as strong as mine.
I still think it'd be easier just to burn them entirely, he argued.
Tasha smiled as she brushed her hair into a tighter ponytail. Yeah, she could definitely do without that hair, particularly since I knew how much Dimitri liked long hair.
Easier because it involves less focus. It's sloppy. Your magic will be stronger in the long run if you can learn this. And, like I said, it has its uses.
I didn't want to agree with her, but I couldn't help it.
It could be really useful if you were fighting with a guardian, I said excitedly, especially if completely burning a Strigoi takes so much energy. This way, you use just a quick burst of your strength to distract the Strigoi, and it will distract one since they hate fire so much. Then, that's all the time a guardian would need to stake them. You could take down a whole bunch of Strigoi that way.
Tasha grinned at me. Some Moroi, like Lissa and Adrian, smiled without showing their teeth. Tasha always showed hers, including the fangs.
Exactly. You and I'll have to go Strigoi hunting someday, she teased.
I don't think so, I replied. The words in and of themselves weren't that bad, but the tone I used to deliver them certainly was. Cold, unfriendly. Tasha looked momentarily surprised at my abrupt change in attitude, but shrugged it off. Shock from Lissa traveled to me through the bond. Tasha didn't seem bothered, however. She chatted with us a bit longer and made plans to see Christian for dinner. Lissa gave me a sharp look as she, Christian, and I walked down the elaborate spiral staircase leading back down to the lobby.
What was that about? She asked.
What was what about? I asked innocently.
Rose, she said meaningfully. It was hard to play dumb when your friend knew you could read her mind. I knew exactly what she was talking about.
You being a bitch to Tasha.
I wasn't that much of a bitch.
You were rude, she exclaimed, stepping out of the way of a bunch of Moroi children who came tearing through the lobby. They were bundled up in parkas, and a weary-looking Moroi ski instructor followed them. I put my hands on my hips.
Look, I'm just grumpy, okay? Didn't get much sleep. Besides, I'm not like you. I don't have to be polite all the time.
As happened so often lately, I couldn't believe what I'd just said. Lissa stared at me, more astonished than hurt. Christian glowered, on the verge of snapping back at me, when Mason mercifully approached us. He hadn't needed a cast or anything, but he had a slight limp to his walk.
Hey there, Hopalong, I said, sliding my hand into his.
Christian put his anger for me on hold and turned to Mason.
Is it true your suicidal moves finally caught up with you?
Mason's eyes were on me.
Is it true you were hanging out with Adrian Ivashkov?
I what?
I heard you guys got drunk last night.
You did? Asked Lissa, startled.
I looked between both their faces.
No, of course not. I barely know him.
But you do know him,
pushed Mason.
Barely.
He's got a bad reputation, warned Lissa.
Yeah,
said Christian.
He goes through a lot of girls.
I couldn't believe this.
Will you guys lay off? I talked to him for like 5 minutes, and that's only because he was blocking my way inside. Where are you getting all this?
Immediately, I answered my own question.
Maya.
Mason nodded and had the grace to look embarrassed.
Since when do you talk to her? I asked.
I just ran into her, that's all, he told me.
And you believed her? You know she lies half the time.
Yeah, but there's usually some truth in the lies, and you did talk to him.
Yes, talk. That's it.
I really had been trying to give some serious thought about dating Mason, so I didn't appreciate him not believing me. He had actually helped me unravel Maya's lies earlier in the school year, so I was surprised he'd been so paranoid about them now. Maybe if his feelings really had grown for me, he was more susceptible to jealousy. Surprisingly, it was Christian who came to the rescue and changed the subject.
I suppose there's no skiing today, huh?
He pointed to Mason's ankle, immediately triggering an indignant response.
What? You think this is going to slow me down?
Asked Mason. His anger diminished, replaced by that burning need to prove himself, the need he and I both shared. Lissa and Christian looked at him like he was crazy, but I knew nothing we said would stop him.
Just want to come with us?
I asked Lissa and Christian. Lissa shook her head. We can't. We have to go to this luncheon being hosted by the Contas. Christian groaned.
Well, you have to go.
She elbowed him.
So do you. The invitation said I get to bring a guest. Besides, this is just a warm-up for the big one.
Which one is that?
Asked Mason.
Priscilla Vada's huge dinner,
sighed Christian. Seeing him look so pained made me smile.
The queen's best friend. All the snobbiest royals will be there, and I'll have to wear a suit.
Mason flashed me a grin. His earlier antagonism was gone.
Skiing sounding better and better, huh?
Less of a dress code. We left the Moroi behind and went outside. Mason couldn't compete with me in the same way he had yesterday. His movements were slow and awkward. Still, he did remarkably well when one considered everything. The injury wasn't as bad as we'd feared, but he had the prudence to stick to extremely easy runs. The full moon hung in the blankness, a glowing sphere of silvery white. The electric lights overpowered most of its illumination on the ground, but here and there, in the shadows, the moon just barely managed to cast its glow. I wished it were bright enough to reveal the surrounding mountain range, but those peaks stayed shrouded in darkness. I'd forgotten to look at them when it was light out earlier. The runs were super simple for me, but I stayed with Mason and only occasionally teased him about how his remedial skiing was putting me to sleep. Boring runs or no, it was just nice to be outside with my friends, and the activity stirred my blood enough to warm me against the chill air. The light posts lit up the snow, turning it into a vast sea of white, the flakes, crystals sparkling faintly. And if I managed to turn away and block the lights from my field of vision, I could look up and see the stars spilling over the sky. They stood out stark and crystalline in the clear, freezing air. We stayed out for most of the day again, but this time I called it quits early, pretending to be tired, so Mason could get a break. He might manage easy skiing with his tender ankle, but I could tell it was starting to hurt him. Mason and I headed back toward the lodge, walking very close to each other, laughing about something we'd seen earlier. Suddenly, I saw a streak of white in my peripheral vision, and a snowball smashed into Mason's face. I immediately went on the defensive, jerking backward and peering around. Whoops and cries sounded from an area of the resort grounds that held storage sheds and was interspersed with looming pines.
"Too slow, Ashford,"
someone called.
"Doesn't pay to be in love."
More laughs. Mason's best friend, Eddie Castile, and a few other novices from school materialized from behind a cluster of trees. Beyond them, I heard more shouts.
"We'll still take you in, though, if you want to be on our team,"
said Eddie.
"Even if you do dodge like a girl."
"Team?" I asked excitedly. Back at the academy, throwing snowballs was strictly prohibited. School officials were inexplicably afraid that we'd throw snowballs packed with glass shards or razor blades, though I had no clue how they thought we'd get a hold of that kind of stuff in the first place. Not that a snowball fight was that rebellious, but after all the stress I'd been through recently, throwing objects at other people suddenly sounded like the best idea I'd heard in a while. Mason and I dashed off with the others, the prospect of forbidden fighting giving him new energy and causing him to forget the pain in his ankle. We set to the fight with a die-hard zeal. The fight soon became a matter of nailing as many people as possible while dodging attacks from others. I was exceptional at both, and furthered the immaturity by catcalling and shouting silly insults at my victims. By the time someone noticed what we were doing and yelled at us, we were all laughing and covered with snow. Mason and I once again started back for the lodge, and our mood was so high, I knew the Adrian thing was long forgotten. Indeed, Mason looked at me just before we went inside.
"Sorry, I jumped all over you about Adrian earlier."
I squeezed his hand. "It's okay. I know Maya can tell some pretty convincing stories."
"Yeah, but even if you were with him, it's not like I have any right."
I stared at him, surprised to see his usual brash countenance turn shy. "Don't you?" I asked. A smile turned up his lips.
"Do I?"
Smiling back, I stepped forward and kissed him. His lips felt amazingly warm in the freezing air.
It wasn't like the earth-shattering kiss I'd had with Dimitri before the trip, but it was sweet and nice. A friendly sort of kiss that maybe could turn into more. At least, that was how I saw it. From the look on Mason's face, it appeared his whole world had been rocked.
"Wow," he said, eyes wide. The moonlight made his eyes look silvery blue.
"You see?" I said. "Nothing to worry about. Not Adrian. Not anybody." We kissed again, a bit longer this time, before finally dragging ourselves apart. Mason was clearly in a better mood, as well as he should have been, and I dropped into bed with a smile on my face. I wasn't technically sure if Mason and I were a couple now, but we were very close to it. But when I slept, I dreamed about Adrian Ivashkov. I stood with him on the porch again, only it was summer. The air was balmy and warm, and the sun hung bright in the sky, coating everything in golden light. I hadn't been in this much sun since living among humans. All around, the mountains and valleys were green and alive. Birds sang everywhere. Adrian leaned against the porch's railing, glanced over, and did a double take when he saw me.
"Oh, didn't expect to see you here," he smiled. "I was right. You are devastating when you're cleaned up."
Instinctively, I touched the skin around my eye.
"It's gone," he said.
Even without being able to see it, I somehow knew he was right. "You aren't smoking."
"Bad habit," he said.
He nodded toward me.
"You scared? You're wearing a lot of protection."
I frowned, then looked down. I hadn't noticed my clothing. I wore a pair of embroidered jeans I'd seen once but had been unable to afford. My T-shirt was cropped, showing off my stomach, and I wore a belly button ring. I'd always wanted to get my belly button pierced, but I had never been able to afford it. The charm I now wore here was a little silver dangly one, and hanging at the end of it was that weird blue eye pendant my mom had given me. Lissa's tchotchke was wound around my wrist. I looked back up at Adrian, studying the way the sun shone off his brown hair. Here, in full daylight, I could see that his wore here was a little silver dangly one, and hanging at the end of it was that weird blue eye pendant my mom had given me. Lissa's tchotchke was wound around my wrist. I looked back up at Adrian, studying the way the sun shone off his brown hair. Here, in full daylight, I could see that his eyes were indeed green, a deep emerald, as opposed to Lissa's pale jade. Something startling suddenly occurred to me.
"Doesn't all this sun bother you?"
He gave a lazy shrug.
"Nah, it's my dream."
"No, it's my dream."
"Are you sure?"
His smile returned. I felt confused.
I don't know."
He chuckled, but a moment later the laughter faded. For the first time since I'd met him, he looked serious.
"Why do you have so much darkness around you?"
I frowned. "What?"
"You're surrounded in blackness."
His eyes studied me shrewdly, but not in a checking-me-out sort of way.
"I've never seen anyone like you. Shadows everywhere. I never would have guessed it. Even while you're standing here, the shadows keep growing."
I looked down at my hands but saw nothing out of the ordinary. I glanced back up. "I'm shadow-kissed."
"What's that mean?"
"I died once." I'd never talked to anyone other than Lissa and Viktor Doshkov about that, but this was a dream. It didn't matter. "And I came back." Wonder lit his face.
"Ah, interesting."
I woke up. Someone was shaking me. It was Lissa. Her feelings hit me so hard through the bond that I briefly snapped into her mind and found myself looking at me. Weird didn't begin to cover it. I pulled back into myself, trying to sift through the terror and alarm coming from her.
"What's wrong?"
"There's been another Strigoi attack."
Chapter 12. I was out of bed in a flash. We found the entire lodge abuzz with the news,
People clustered in small groups in the halls. Family members sought each other out. Some conversations were conducted in terrified whispers. Some were loud and easy to overhear. I stopped a few people, trying to get the story straight. Everyone had a different version of what had happened, though, and some wouldn't even pause to talk. They hurried past, either seeking out loved ones or preparing to leave the resort, convinced there might be a safer place elsewhere. Frustrated with the differing stories, I finally, reluctantly, knew I had to seek out one of the two sources who would give me solid information. My mother or Dimitri. It was like flipping a coin. I wasn't really thrilled with either one of them right now. I debated momentarily and finally decided on my mother, seeing as how she wasn't getting it on with Tasha Ozera. The door to my mother's room was ajar, and as Lissa and I entered, I saw that a sort of makeshift headquarters had been established here. Lots of guardians were milling around, moving in and out, and discussing strategy. A few gave us odd looks, but no one stopped or questioned us. Lissa and I slid onto a small sofa to listen to a conversation my mother was having. She stood with a group of guardians, one of whom was Dimitri. So much for avoiding him. His brown eyes glanced at me briefly, and I averted my gaze. I didn't want to deal with my troubled feelings for him right now. Lissa and I soon discerned the details. 8 Moroi had been killed along with their 5 guardians. 3 Moroi were still missing, either dead or turned Strigoi. The attack hadn't really happened near here. It had been somewhere in Northern California. Nonetheless, a tragedy like this couldn't help but reverberate within the Moroi world, and for some, 2 states away was far too close. People were terrified, and I soon learned what in particular made this attack so notable.
"There had to be more than last time," said my mother.
"More?" exclaimed one of the other guardians. "That last group was unheard of. I still can't believe 9 Strigoi managed to work together. You expect me to believe they managed to get more organized still?"
"Yes," snapped my mother.
"Any evidence of humans?"
someone else asked. My mother hesitated, then,
"Yes, more broken wards. And the way it was all conducted, it's identical to the Badika attack."
Her voice was hard, but there was a kind of weariness in it, too. It wasn't physical exhaustion, though. It was mental, I realized. Strain and hurt over what they were talking about. I always thought of my mother as some sort of unfeeling killing machine, but this was clearly hard for her. It was a hard, ugly matter to discuss, but at the same time, she was tackling it without hesitation. It was her duty. A lump formed in my throat that I quickly swallowed down. Humans. Identical to the Badika attack. Ever since that massacre, we'd extensively analyzed the oddity of such a large group of Strigoi teaming up and recruiting humans. We'd spoken in vague terms about if something like this ever happens again. But no one had seriously talked about this group, the Badika killers, doing it again. One time was a fluke. Maybe a bunch of Strigoi had happened to gather and impulsively decided to go on a raid. It was horrible, but we could write that off. But now? Now it looked as though that group of Strigoi hadn't been a random occurrence. They'd united with purpose, utilizing humans strategically, and had attacked again. We now had what could be a pattern. Strigoi actively seeking out large groups of prey. Serial killings. We could no longer trust the protective magic of the wards. We couldn't even trust sunlight. Humans could move around in the day, scouting and sabotaging. The light was no longer safe. I remembered what I'd said to Dimitri at the Badika house. This changes everything, doesn't it? My mother flipped through some papers on a clipboard.
They don't have forensic details yet, but the same number of Strigoi couldn't have done this. None of the Drozdovs or their staff escaped. With 5 guardians, 7 Strigoi would have been preoccupied, at least temporarily, for some to escape.
We're looking at 9 or 10, maybe.
Janine's right, said Dimitri. And if you look at the venue, it's too big. 7 couldn't have covered it.
The Drozdovs were one of the 12 royal families. They were large and prosperous, not like Lys's dying clan. They had plenty of family members to go around, but obviously an attack like this was still horrible. Furthermore, something about them tickled my brain. There was something I should remember, something I should know about the Drozdovs. While part of my mind puzzled that out, I watched my mother with fascination. I'd listened to her tell her stories. I'd seen and felt her fight. But really, truly, I'd never seen her in action in a real-life crisis. She showed every bit of that hard control she did around me, but here, I could see how necessary it was. A situation like this created panic, even among the Guardians. I could sense those who were so keyed up they wanted to do something drastic. My mother was a voice of reason, a reminder that they had to stay focused and fully assess the situation. Her composure calmed everybody. Her strong manner inspired them. This, I realized, was how a leader behaved. Dimitri was just as collected as she was, but he deferred to her to run things. I had to remind myself sometimes that he was young as far as Guardians went. They discussed the attack more, how the Drozdovs had been having a belated Christmas party in a banquet hall when they were attacked. First Badikas, now Drozdovs, muttered one Guardian.
They're going after royals.
They're going after Moroi, said Dimitri flatly.
Royal, non-royal, it doesn't matter.
Royal, non-royal? I suddenly knew why the Drozdovs were important. My spontaneous instincts wanted me to jump up and ask a question right now, but I knew better. This was the real deal. This was no time for irrational behavior. I wanted to be as strong as my mother and Dimitri, so I waited for the discussion to end. When the group started to break up, I leapt up off the sofa and pushed my way toward my mother.
Rose, she said, surprised. Like in Stan's class, she hadn't noticed me in the room.
What are you doing here?
It was such a stupid question, I didn't try to answer it. What did she think I was doing here? This was one of the biggest things to happen to the Moroi.
I pointed to her clipboard.
Who else was killed?
Irritation wrinkled her forehead.
Drozdovs.
But who else?
Rose, we don't have time.
They had staff, right? Dimitri said non-royals. Who were they?
Again, I saw the weariness in her. She took these deaths hard.
I don't know all the names.
Flipping through a few pages, she turned the clipboard toward me.
There.
I scanned the list. My heart sank.
Okay, I told her. Thanks. Lyssa and I left them to go about their business. I wished I could have helped, but the Guardians ran smoothly and efficiently on their own. They had no need for novices underfoot.
What was that about? Asked Lyssa, once we were heading back to the main part of the lodge.
The Drozdov staff, I said. Maya's mom worked for them.
Lyssa gasped.
And?
I sighed.
And her name was on the list.
Oh, God.
Lyssa stopped walking. She stared off into space, blinking back tears.
Oh, God, she repeated.
I moved in front of her and placed my hands on her shoulders. She was shaking.
It's okay, I said.
Her fear came to me in waves, but it was a numbed fear. Shock.
This is going to be okay.
You heard them, she said.
There's a band of Strigoi organizing and attacking us. How many? Are they coming here?
No, I said firmly. I had no evidence of that, of course. We're safe here.
Poor Maya.
There was nothing I could say to that. I thought Maya was an absolute bitch, but I wouldn't wish this on anyone, not even my worst enemy. Which, technically, she was. Immediately, I corrected that thought. Maya wasn't my worst enemy. I couldn't bear to leave Lyssa's side for the rest of the day.
I knew there were no Strigoi lurking in the lodge, but my protective instincts ran too strong. Guardians protected their Moroi. Like usual, I also worried about her being anxious and upset. So I did my best to diffuse those feelings. The other guardians provided reassurance for Moroi, too. They didn't walk side by side with Moroi, but they reinforced lodge security and stayed in constant communication with guardians at the scene of the attack. Information flowed in all day about the grisly specifics, as well as speculation about where the band of Strigoi was. Little of this was shared with novices, of course. While the guardians did what they did best, the Moroi also did what they, unfortunately, did best. Talk. With so many royals and other important Moroi at the lodge, a meeting was organized that night to discuss what had happened and what might be done in the future. Nothing official would be decided here. The Moroi had a queen and a governing council elsewhere for those types of decisions. Everyone knew, though, that opinions gathered here would make their way up the chain of command. Our future safety could very well depend on what was discussed in this meeting. It was held in an enormous banquet hall inside the lodge, one with a podium and plenty of seating. Despite the businesslike atmosphere, you could tell this room had been designed for things other than meetings about massacres and defense. The carpet had the texture of velvet and showed an ornate floral design in shades of silver and black. The chairs were made of black polished wood and had high backs, clearly intended for fancy dining. Paintings of long-dead Moroi royalty hung on the walls. I stared briefly at one of a queen whose name I didn't know. She wore an old-fashioned dress, too heavy on lace for my tastes, and had pale hair like Lissa's. Some guy I didn't know was in charge of moderating and stood at the podium. Most of the royals on hand gathered at the front of the room. Everyone else, including students, took seats wherever they could. Christian and Mason had found Lissa and me by that point, and we all started to sit in the back when Lissa suddenly shook her head. "I'm going to sit in the front." The three of us stared at her. I was too dumbfounded to probe her mind. "Look," she pointed. "The royals are sitting up there, sitting by family." It was true. Members of the same clans had clustered near each other. Badikas, Ivashkovs, Zelkloses, etc. Tasha sat there as well, but she was by herself. Christian was the only other Ozera there. "I need to be up there," said Lissa. "No one expects you to be there," I told her. "I have to represent the Dragomirs." Christian scoffed. "It's all a bunch of royal bullshit." Her face set into a determined expression. "I need to be up there." I opened myself up to Lissa's feelings and liked what I found. She'd spent most of the day quiet and afraid, much as she had when we'd found out about Maya's mom. That fear was within her still, but it was overpowered by a steady confidence and determination. She recognized that she was one of the ruling Moroi, and as much as the idea of roving bands of Strigoi scared her, she wanted to do her part. "You should do it," I said softly. I also liked the idea of her defying Christian. Lissa met my eyes and smiled. She knew what I had sensed. A moment later, she turned to Christian. "You should join your aunt." Christian opened his mouth to protest. If not for the horribleness of the situation, seeing Lissa order him around would have been funny. He was always stubborn and difficult. Those who tried to push him didn't succeed. Watching his face, I saw the same realization I'd had about Lissa come over him. He liked seeing her strong, too. He pressed his lips together in a grimace. "Okay." He caught her hand, and the two of them walked off toward the front. Mason and I sat down. Just before things started, Dimitri sat on the other side of me, hair tied behind his neck and the leather coat draping around him as he settled in the chair.
I glanced at him in surprise, but said nothing. There were few guardians at this gathering. Most were too busy doing damage control. It would figure. There I was, stuck between both of my men. The meeting kicked off shortly thereafter. Everyone was eager to talk about how they thought the Moroi should be saved, but really, two theories got the most attention.
"The answer's all around us," said one royal.
Once he'd been given leave to speak, he stood by his chair and looked around the room.
"Here, in places like this lodge and St. Vladimir's, we send our children to safe places, places where they have safety in numbers and can be easily guarded. And look how many of us made it here, children and adults alike. Why don't we live this way all the time?"
"Plenty of us already do," someone shouted back.
The man waved that off.
"A couple of families here and there, or a town with a large Moroi population. But those Moroi are still decentralized. Most don't pool their resources, their guardians, their magic. If we could emulate this model,"
he spread his hands out,
"we'd never have to worry about Strigoi again."
"And Moroi could never interact with the rest of the world again," I muttered. "Well, until humans discovered secret vampire cities sprouting up in the wilderness, then we'd have lots of interactions."
The other theory about how to protect the Moroi involved fewer logistical problems but had greater personal impact, particularly for me.
"The problem is simply that we don't have enough guardians." This plan's advocate was some woman from the Seltsky clan. "And so, the answer is simple. Get more. The Drozdovs had 5 guardians, and that wasn't enough. Only 6 to protect over 12 Moroi? That's unacceptable. It's no wonder these kinds of things keep happening."
"Where do you propose getting more guardians from?"
asked the man who'd been in favor of Moroi banding together.
"They're kind of a limited resource."
She pointed to where I and a few other novices sat. "We've got plenty already. I've watched them train. They're deadly. Why are we waiting until they turn 18? If we accelerated the training program and focused more on combat training than bookwork, we could turn out new guardians when they're 16.
Dimitri made a sound low in his throat that didn't seem happy. Leaning forward, he placed his elbows on his knees and rested his chin in his hands, eyes narrowed in thought.
"Not only that, we have plenty of potential guardians going to waste. Where are all the Dampir women? Our races are intertwined. The Moroi are doing their part to help the Dampir survive. Why aren't these women doing theirs? Why aren't they here?"
A long, sultry laugh came as an answer. All eyes turned toward Tasha Ozera. Whereas many of the other royals had dressed up, she was easy and casual. She wore her usual jeans, a white tank top that showed a bit of midriff, and a blue, lacy knit cardigan that came to her knees. Glancing at the moderator, she asked,
"May I?"
He nodded. The Seltsky woman sat down. Tasha stood up. Unlike the other speakers, she strode right up to the podium so she could be clearly seen by everyone. Her glossy black hair was pulled back into a ponytail, completely exposing her scars in a way I suspected was intentional. Her face was bold and defiant. Beautiful.
"Those women aren't here, Monica, because they're too busy raising their children. You know, the ones you want to start sending out to the fronts as soon as they can walk. And please, don't insult us by acting like the Moroi do a huge favor to the Dampirs by helping them reproduce. Maybe it's different in your family, but for the rest of us, sex is fun. The Moroi doing it with Dampirs aren't really making that big of a sacrifice."
Dimitri had straightened up now, his expression no longer angry. Probably he was excited that his new girlfriend had mentioned sex. Irritation shot through me, and I hoped that if I had a homicidal look on my face, people would assume it was for Strigoi and not the woman currently addressing us.
"B
Beyond Dimitri, I suddenly noticed Maya sitting by herself, farther down the row. I hadn't realized she was here. She was slumped in her seat. Her eyes were red-rimmed, her face paler than usual. A funny ache burned in my chest, one I'd never expected her to bring out.
"And the reason we're waiting for these guardians to turn 18 is so that we can allow them to enjoy some pretense of a life before forcing them to spend the rest of their days in constant danger. They need those extra years to develop mentally as well as physically. Pull them out before they're ready, treat them like they're parts on an assembly line, and you're just creating Strigoi fodder."
A few people gasped at Tasha's callous choice of words, but she succeeded in getting everyone's attention.
"You create more fodder still if you try making the other Dampier women become guardians. You can't force them into that life if they don't want it. This entire plan of yours to get more guardians relies on throwing children and the unwilling into harm's way just so you can barely stay one step ahead of the enemy. I would have said it's the stupidest plan I've ever heard if I hadn't already had to listen to his."
She pointed to the first speaker, the one who had wanted Moroi compounds. Embarrassment clouded his features.
"Enlighten us then, Natasha," he said. "Tell us what you think we should do, seeing as you have so much experience with Strigoi."
A thin smile played on Tasha's lips, but she didn't rise to the insult.
"What do I think?"
She strode closer to the stage's front, gazing at us as she answered his question.
"I think we should stop coming up with plans that involve us relying on someone or something to protect us. You think there are too few guardians? That's not the problem. The problem is that there are too many Strigoi, and we've let them multiply and become more powerful because we do nothing about them except have stupid arguments like this. We run and hide behind the Dampiers and let the Strigoi go unchecked. It's our fault. We are the reason those Drozdovs died. You want an army? Well, here we are. Dampiers aren't the only ones who can learn to fight. The question, Monica, isn't where the Dampier women are in this fight. The question is, where are we?"
Tasha was shouting by now, and the exertion turned her cheeks pink. Her eyes shone in her impassioned feelings, and when combined with the rest of her pretty features, and even with the scar, she made a striking figure. Most people couldn't take their eyes off her. Lissa watched Tasha with wonder, inspired by her words. Mason looked hypnotized. Dimitri looked impressed.